As far as I know, he's never been on national television before. This is the first time. And so welcome, Harold. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, how far back do you want to start?
A childhood.
Childhood was on the farm in Northwest Ohio. Part of my first experience with other ethnic groups was when we had migrant workers on our farm. And my father kept saying, you know, these are people, and we'll treat them as such. And the people kept coming and going because the other farmers were not treating their migrant laborers at that point in time in the early 50s as human beings. And so that was my first impulse to the sense that my work would be maybe different. I always wanted to be a preacher, by the way, when I was a kid, from 3 years old on up. And so when I was ninth grade, I went away to Concordia, Milwaukee. I'm the oldest of five kids, by the way. And had good Sunday school teachers that always affirmed that I should become a pastor and all that sort of thing. And out of my home church, I was the first in 100 years to become a pastor. So I'm carrying all kinds of burdens on my shoulders at that point. But anyway, I went to Concordia, Milwaukee for 6 years and senior college and here at the seminary and in St. Louis. And a classmate of mine, Tim Rares, and I we lived together that 1 year. It's okay to say that years ago. Now it sounds funny to say you lived together, but anyway, we did. And we signed up for a mission church. We wanted to be involved in the mission of the church. And so we signed up in the beginning of the year, you know, for a new church. And then we went looking on the map, and here the thing was the A.C. Brower Memorial Chapel down at Shoto and 12th. No longer is there, but we found this place. And we said, this is not what we had intended to get involved with. We wanted to have a nice, growing suburban church, you know, a new mission. And got there, and the pastor at the time said, well, if you want to be here, you got to find your own class. Pack your pockets full of cigarettes and quarters and climb the high-rises and recruit a class. And that was our beginning. And from that point on, I brought a couple of the kids out to the campus here, and my dossier that got written up, you know, as they do, was a dossier that I was willing to work with black kids. That was in my thing, that phrase. And my vicarage was in San Antonio, Texas, with the mother church at San Antonio, St. Paul's. And what had happened to that parish in my vicarage year was Hemisphere had wiped out half of the parish and moved it all around San Antonio. And the congregation was in the midst of absolute chaos. The school that suddenly wasn't full enough, and you had a pastor that was very gung-ho, and I was their first vicar, and on and on. And so it was all kind of new learning experience. Every place I got involved in was new learning experience. So that when I was in fourth year STEM, the goal was to get me and about 10 other guys in specialized ministries, quote unquote. You know how they do that at the end of the year. Interview upon interview. Harry Koiner was here at that time, and interviews upon interviews, and I was going to get sent to Norfolk, Virginia, to work in a neighborhood center that ALC and Missouri Synod had been working on together, but it had been closed by the police because the Panthers and the police got into it, or I don't know what it was. Anyway, I said, geez, I had no experience in that. Out of that, I got sent to Springfield, Illinois, to a black Lutheran church that had been started in 1888, Holy Trinity, and had a pastor for 23 years before I got there. Seminary students had run the place, owned the place, and the reason for existence of that parish was to accept seminary students. And it was a terrible experience. I was called as a missionary at large to develop 2 square blocks of urban renewal property, but there was no commitment to do it. I found out after 2 years of hiring an architect, even. I went so far as to hire an architect to design the buildings according to the specs that we had as program, and then we found out there was no commitment. I learned a lot about politics. But anyway, I'm married now. My wife, my father-in-law graduated back in the years when you didn't have calls for a couple of years. And so to get married, his father-in-law-to-be said, you got to have a call, man. So he started St. Philip's Lutheran Church in Toledo, Ohio. So all my background has been tied in with a different track than the mainline Missouri Synod track. And while I was at Springfield, I sat in the library and read all the stuff there was about history of our church's work in black ministry, read all those documents about this long called the Colored Lutheran. Those of you who don't know about that, it's not in our seminary here, library, but it gave the history of all that involvement. And the people who raised me to be open to others were the AME pastors down the street and the Black Baptist pastors. And in 1969, Jesse Jackson was in Springfield a lot, helping us to coordinate marches on the state capitol. That's a little bit of my history.
Okay.
I'm a farmer, however. I like to have to dig every spring. I'm digging right now when I'm home.
Well, very, very good. Back in the days when you went to Springfield, now that was a lack of commitment on the part of the Illinois district?
Well, it was the years to be guilty, you know, and to do things out of the hip pocket, out of guilt. So they bought two blocks of urban renewal property on a voice vote, I understand, or something like that at the district convention. And then therefore they had to legitimize that, and so they needed a pastor to come to town, so I was it.
Aha. Okay, now how did you finally end up in Detroit?
Oh, I was in Springfield for 7 years, 68 to 75, and I'd received several calls, and I'd heard about a church in Detroit one time when I was at a seminar here in 1973. We were talking about what it is, what's it going to take for the Missouri Synod to really be involved in the black community and to not be there as paternalistic tokenism, et cetera, et cetera. We need to have some parishes that can go through a time of change and who may be able to weather the storm without going on subsidy. And is there such a place? And the name of Greenfield Peace came up. I thought no more about it until 3 years later. I got a call, or 2 years later. Got a call to the place, and I've been there since 75. And the goal of going there was to treat everybody the same in worship, and also to see if we couldn't take a congregation through transition without going on subsidy, getting caught up in the welfare mentality that was.
Okay, I want to move back a minute to your research in terms of Missouri Synod's involvement in ministry among black people. Was there not, in the early work, a mission board to Negroes or Negro mission board?
Well, all of the history I don't remember very well. I can tell you, however, the name of the congregation in Springfield. Its official legal name. It's 100 years old this year. The name of the congregation, which was organized as the first of the congregations north of the Mason-Dixon line of the old Synodical Conference, and the Synodical Conference work was to cross Selma and the Black Belt of Alabama. But as I read the history anyway, the name of this congregation is significant. It tells us where we were at and where we're not too far from yet, in my opinion, in many ways. But the name of the congregation was Holy Trinity Evangelical Lutheran Church of the Synodical Conference to the Negro Heathen. That was the name. That's on the official original document. Jack Price's grandfather was the head of the Synodical Conference at that time, or that committee that helped to organize this mission outreach. And I don't know. I'm not so acquainted with a lot of the history as I am with having read it to understand that, you know, we hadn't progressed very far in 1968 yet.
Yeah, I think what I'm trying to get at is there are certain attitudes toward persons that individuals exhibit and which institutions and churches exhibit. So this morning, Ellen was talking about, you know, the way that people react to newcomers, the way that they react to people whose name isn't Schmidt or Schultz or something like that. And here we are looking at something very similar to my experience, which is deaf work. And in those days, the Synodical Conference had a board for missions to the deaf, and a board for missions to the blind, and a board for missions to the colored, I guess, or whatever it was, was part
heathen.
Of that thing.
Heathen was the word.
The heathen, right. And I guess they thought the deaf were heathen too. But at this point, you have an attitude.
It was we who thought that.
What do you mean, we, Missouri Synod?
Well, I mean, we didn't know, whoever we, this mainline denomination is, it was not they. You know, because the we, they thing, you know, is still what goes on within our denomination in terms of, goes on within my congregation. 95% of the congregation is made up of black citizens, but it is not their church yet.
Explain yourself.
Well, it's still considered to be their church. Theirs, whoever started Greenfield Peace 100 years ago. That's 100 years old, too. And the perception is not yet this is going to be ours for the future. It's struggling at that right now. We're at this bottom of the limbo stage, you know, of saying, what are we doing? Why are we here? Whose is this? And part of that goes back to this sense of, you know, paternalism, patronizing, lack of being able to say, you and I can relate as brothers and sisters in Christ. There's a sense of yes-sirism that goes on subconsciously, even among folks that got good education. Walk into a mainline denomination like the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, has its German identities, even though our history at this parish I'm at now was ULC for several years. It was independent Jehovah Lutheran Synod for several years. It's only been Missouri Synod since 38 or 37. But this is not us yet. Mm-hmm. Even though we've struggled to try to say it is, it still is not there yet.
Do you think there's like a second-class mentality?
Well, second class is not quite right, although I think that's maybe how we, the denomination, look at it. You know, it's we who have accepted them, not we who are the church. You know, and that comes through a whole lot and a lot of stuff I read, and even with the church growth stuff. You know, it's we have to do things to reach them. Well, no, the Spirit calls us to be us. And that's a thing that I preach about, thing I talk about, and it hasn't come through yet. See, Detroit, too, is another little special animal. We have a lot of kingdoms. Well, there are some in St. Louis, too, but, you know, we had a lot of parishes that didn't relate to each other very well over the years, and they were large institutions of their own making. Our parish was not one of those in its history, but it's weathered the storm of change. It has lost its identity 3 times already in its history, and has lost it again.
Okay, well, let's move to that point at this very moment. And that is the history of Greenfield Peace. What was its original identity, and where is it?
Okay. Pastor was sent from Germany to find German-speaking Lutherans in a Meislinger Missionary Institute. Came to Baltimore and then to Detroit, and he got there and he said, you know, folks aren't talking German here. So he didn't recruit only Germans. He had German services, but also there was other. And it was part of the Jehovah Lutheran Synod. There were 13 congregations in that around the country. Baltimore, most of them, and in the Detroit area. And 1920 or so, they joined the United Lutheran Church for a while because this pastor went out of business. I mean, he died, he got old, whatever. And then they were United Lutheran Church for a while. In their history, though, they were a swampland first, and there was a farm. He had about 30 members. The church burnt down, and then some folks left, and they were down to the last few, and they decided again. They got up to 75 and 80, and part of the church blew down. And it was a big decision again to change. And then he had a bad pastor during the Depression. He lasted a year, and you can find no history. The whole history of him is expunged, except his name once. So something terrible happened, and no one remembers it. The son of the founding pastor just died here 2 years ago, and I have 3 of his daughters still living. Only one's a member yet of this parish, but they still tell me about the founding days, you know, and all the changes that took place. They talk about the changes as being that which needed to have happened. Mm. Well, then it was large farms, then it got split up into truck farms, and those folks all left each time, and they had to decide, do we go on again or do we stop? Well, this time, Greenfield Peace as a parish, was, by the way, it was always known as Jehovah Lutheran Church in 1966. Paul Faust, some of you know Paul Faust, the evangelism fellow, he was a pastor there for 5 years, and the church went from 300 members to 1,400 members in a few years, and then the white flight took place in Detroit. And all 1,300 left, and no one missed him. All he did is paid off the bills over a 4-year period. And they changed the name because he didn't like it when he got accused of being a Jehovah's Witness. And so they changed the name for that reason. And I was going to tell you something more, but I've forgotten. Oh, in terms of the identity, the Greenfield Peace as a parish, when I took the call, had already made the decision 5 years before the disturbance, some call it the riot of Detroit in 67, had made the decision that the congregation would remain in the community and anybody who lived there was to be a part of that church. Now, that was faster than some of the other LCMS churches, at least, said that in Detroit. Everybody else got on a bandwagon after 67. Our school had gone from a small school, and a decision was made to have a separate grade per classroom. And so while the church started going this way, the school was going this way, and have mercy, you know, we have had to add on classrooms, rent space from the neighbor's church, and they didn't like us messing up their church, so it was cheaper to build onto the school building than to rent commercial space. So we went into a building program in 1976 first, and another big one in 82, and it almost destroyed the place. But the reason for building was to do outreach with the school. But right now we're suffering the consequences. Most guys tell me, you go in a building program, you leave after 2 years. Well, my reason for doing it was to do outreach, and so I've committed myself to stay through the horrendous times of getting that focus back on mission and ministry.
Mm-hmm. Now, that how is that area situated in terms of Detroit? In other words, how far
northwest,
are you from
northwest,
the center of Detroit?
Well, we're northwest, only 2 miles from the outer edge of Detroit. Residential community, single residence houses, few apartment buildings in the area, 2-story at max, and few of them. Right now it's a place where people are living until they can escape Detroit, black citizens now. So we're having a flight now into 3 of the suburbs to the northwest. But there are no other Lutheran churches until another 4 miles. And so, you know, those people who are part of our parish will probably remain a part of it for...
Well, has the history of the parish been an experience of, you know, come and leave, come and leave, come and leave, come and leave? In other words, there's no stability in the neighborhood, really.
Well, the neighborhood, the stability is going to be, there's always going to be young families buying houses and staying there while the kids grow up. That's what SEMCOG studies tell us. That's what, you know, census studies. So that's why we went into building under the school building. We have 20 years, we figure, of that kind of outreach. The brick houses will, if people take care of them the last 30, 40 years, 50 years, and longer, if they don't take care of them, there's about a 25-year lifespan left in the houses as they presently stand. So that's how much time we have to try to effectively plant the seed of the gospel in people.
Okay. One of the things I think that we're concerned about in growing churches is the image of the church. And there's a little story my colleague Bill Schmelter tells about. He thinks the ideal name for any church would be the Church of St. Rahab the Harlot. And he thinks it would be great for evangelism because whereas Jehovah was the problem, this would not be. You, two people would come to your door and they would say, "We're from the Lutheran Church of St. Rahab the Harlot." Would create, you know, instant interest, and then you could get into the gospel and forgiveness, and she was one of the grandparents of of Jesus, you know. But that has nothing to do with our discussion. Back to
I'd like to name it Jehovah again, because I'd like to take the brunt of that rather than avoiding it. I think that's the best way to handle it. You have an opportunity to talk about Jehovah God as contrasted to let's not get into the Jehovah Witness. You know, to me it's avoiding the challenge rather than facing it.
Now, what projection, okay, or what image is projected by a church, let's say, one, when it stays in the neighborhood, and two, when it's doing some of the work you described, particularly in the school? We hear a lot about perceived images of Lutheran churches, so that when you go out and say, "I'm from, you know, Greenfield Peace," to somebody say, "Oh, that's Lutheran, that's the church where they sing those lousy hymns." You know, what kind of feedback do you get, or what kind of purposeful image do you wish to project?
Well, part of it is that we wish to remain in this neighborhood. We have repaired buildings, fixed them up. We're in a landscaping project now. People donating in memory and honor and thankfulness for Aunt Tilly, who is still living, and my kids, who are there, are a blessing, you know, and people say they give a gift for that. Part of it, though, is that we're known as a friendly church. We're known as that. We have anywhere from 7 to 8 to 10 visitors out of a worshiping community on average Sunday, total of 175. We're known as a friendly church. When I said I accepted the call there, what I did the first 2 years was write new liturgies every week so that everybody had to work the same. Everybody was equal in worship. We talked about it. We expanded hymns. I typed hymns, and then we got copyright infringement guilt. You know, then we bought... new hymnal. We use the old TLH, we use the worship supplement, we use the convention edition of the LBW, and we use the Hymns for the Family of God, which is a kind of a non-denominational hymnal. And so we have the small red, the large brown, and the small green, you know. And if you're colorblind, too bad. You know, we try not to use more than three a Sunday. But the point is that, you know, everybody had to work the same, including those who were existing members of the congregation. There was no tradition that was held sacred at that point. It was an experiment. That's what I accepted the call, and the boards and that said that's what they wanted, and not just all what I did. They didn't like everything that we did, but I didn't ask permission, you know, because they said we want to have worship be an experience that reaches all people as much as well as we can do that. And so we have lay readers and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that work some days. There's a greeting of peace that takes anywhere from 5 to 7 to 8 minutes, you know, walking around the church. You know, sometimes it's hard to get them back in line to finish the worship, you know, in terms of a formal experience, but that's something we do all the time. And when you don't have that, if I forget to put it in, you know, or I want to think to shorten up the service, I get complaints about that. So we're known as a friendly church. Okay.
What were there any dangers or pitfalls in like, you know, innovative liturgies and what some would call cut and paste liturgies?
Oh, yeah, they're hard work to do, that part of it. Part of it also, though, that the danger, I think, in that is that you start losing a bit of what would be an identity as a Lutheran tradition, so that people say that I've made a choice here compared to other churches that have, you know, free-for-all liturgies. You know, I came to Lutheran Church to find some structure. What you discover, though, is when you do this sort of thing, you end up with a structure, you know. You have a structure that's almost the same. You just put it together with different pieces. But the concept is you can develop a theme idea, just like the propers are to the Lutheran liturgy in its past. There are propers to a service that's different, you know. You do things the same, and some things you do different. You establish a tradition, and I don't know.
What has been the reaction to that? Has it been positive?
Yeah, I've not lost members over that.
What have you lost members over?
Oh, we lost members over. We couldn't find enough elders 1 year, and so at a voice vote, we elected a woman to be an elder. You know, oh my goodness, you know, the world came to an end. We tried to have crash Bible courses. It lasted, you know, 16 weeks to study the rationale for this, why and why not, Synod's position, and those folks that were against it stayed away. So we couldn't have any dialogue, you know, so that was an issue. And another issue was over the, had B&Es. We had about five of them in a row, and the car stolen, and everything busted into. That finally got to some people. But other than that, you know, the big loss was orchestrated. When you moved at Greenfield Peace, your transfer was sent with you if you moved out of the city. There was no, the intention was not to even think of trying to hang on to people. That was an intention when I came as pastor already. It was already in place. That has its wonderful things. You can get rid of people that, you know, you have to worry about. But the problem was that it decimated our 45 and older. We have no financial base. We have no leadership base. We have no history, no continuation of committees. So we have new people trying to manage a growing school and a neighborhood that's changed, and folks that coming into a church saying, now this is a good church, they really know what's going on, only to discover they're the ones that got to be running it. And that has been the most, I think, the most terrible process. Scapegoats have been teachers, principal, and such things, you know, in history as you look at it.
Now, but comparing that, for instance, to a church that has been in a community and has what we call a commuter church, whereas the church is in downtown, let's say, St. Louis, and everyone's coming in from Chesterfield because they have their allegiance. Something I discovered in St. Louis that I've never found in any place that I've ever been before, many of our Lutheran churches in St. Louis have homecomings, okay, where former members who still live in the suburbs come in for a big day on a certain day.
Yeah, well,
that's the other side of this. So you have the community. Would that have been better?
No, but I don't think so. But we're going to try to establish Come Home Sunday as a peer alumni list. Come home. This is the mission. This is the new mission of the church. Your home church is now in a mission posture. Now we have to define that better as we try to get this homecoming concept. That's what we're working on. You know, because not to come home, but to come home to visit Mama. Come home to visit to help take care of Mama. You know, she's trying to wake up again. She needs your prayers, your support, your care. Most of all, your care. To speak well of her as opposed to just give money to her, because, you know, folks can buy off their guilt. We don't want that.
Okay, let's move on to the school. One of the things you said was that the church seemed to get smaller, but the school seemed to get bigger.
No, it did get smaller.
It did get
bigger.
Okay, so there's no seam about it.
No.
Okay. Was that purposely done, or did it happen by accident? And why did you do that?
It was in place when I came. There was an established first and second grade was divided, and from then on, whose kids do you kick out to the third and fourth grade? So it kept expanding. Every inch of space is used. We wear out the building from corner to corner. And that's been a blessing. We have a parking lot. We have 2.5 acres of ground. We have a large athletic field. We have parking for 250 cars. We have security guards that are there when we have big events. And the school expanded, and we could have doubled the size of it with no problem. We had a good reputation. We had horrible things happen. We suddenly had a treasurer who didn't pay Uncle Sam the withholding tax for better than a year, a staff of 11, and didn't tell anybody, didn't report it. All at once, we got stuff started to come, you know, daily from IRS, you know, $56,000 when it was all done. And that was a crisis of 82, right in the middle of the building program. It was fun. No, it was terrible. It was what it was. And that was when the school had just finished expanding to 9 classrooms full, 27 kids a classroom. And we had to raise tuition by 40% January 1, mid-year, because we got a loan for $50,000, but that was a demand. Prove that you will collect. I said, prove that they'll stay. But anyway, it was on paper, and that was the mortgager asked that. We lost 30 families and gained 30 families. So we were in the business of running a school now as opposed to having a church school as much. And then we're still not out of that woods yet.
Now, when you say you're in the business of running a school, who pays the tuition?
Parents do.
Where do they get the money?
They sacrifice, is what they're doing.
Because of what? What don't they want?
They do not want, two things they do not want. One, they do not want their kids unsafe. And number two, they don't trust the Detroit public school system. Maybe a fourth on the line will be they want a Christian education. So therefore, we have an opportunity to be honest with people that we are starting with them at the point that we are going to want to teach parents. And the trouble is to get the parish to fully understand that again, and to get teachers to understand that fully, and to then develop staff support and money enough to pay staff so that they're committed to want to work at that hard. I mean, that's generalizing. You've read about that in other places, but that's where we're at. And yet the school, if we wouldn't have had the school, we wouldn't have better than about 70% of the members we have now who complain about the school at times, but they wouldn't be there if there wouldn't have been the school. And I remind them of that, and it's fact. It can be documented. This last year we've gained, you know, four families from the school during the last year that were unchurched before.
Now, there are a lot of those who say that's all well and good, and the Missouri Synod has always been very good at church growth via the school. But the criticism...
No, we've not been good at that. I mean,
that's maybe not you, but that's what you hear statistically across the Synod.
Oh, I think we're actually better than the average of the Synod. You know, in Detroit, there's very few schools that gather new members through the school yet, because the congregations are fighting. See, we got rid of all those folks.
What do you mean? I don't understand.
Well, many of the parishes in Detroit tried to hang on to their members, and so they kept the policies. We had to have the policy X people out when they moved. Doesn't sound very nice, but I mean, that's kind of what happened. You moved, you got a transfer, you were gone, you know, and we didn't worry about you. We looked to those that were coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in that sense, that's what I mean, how I mean that.
Okay, what I'm getting at, though, is if you buy into the fact that the school is a viable instrument for church growth,
mm-hmm.
Okay, and that you use the school as an entrance for new people to come into the church, those who are most critical of that approach don't question whether it works. They question how much it costs. So what would happen, let's say, if you close the school tomorrow and hire five evangelists? Would it be as successful?
Well, I wouldn't have income to hire five evangelists, number one. I don't have contributions to cover that kind of cost. Right now, parents are, we just challenged the congregation this year to take $10,000 a year more. I'm not sure it's going to work, but the congregation will assume responsibility for all congregational properties. Tuition has been covering all our costs the last 5 years, including all the mortgage payments, etc. We have the highest tuition in Detroit. In fact, one of the highest in the Synod right now. We're at $1,650 for the first kid. For members, it's also $1,650, and they get a grant if they're, quote, this is the new line that board pulled on me. They didn't want to say everybody the same, so members can get a grant back. So now we got who's the good members and who aren't going. That'll be another year of garbage, you know. Whatever it is, if you have a school, I always tell pastors, you know, move from no tuition to full tuition and lose your 50 members right away and get the pain over with. If you're going to go to tuition, get it over with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Don't rape the gospel of its power with all this garbage about good members and not such good members. But we didn't do that. See, we had to go step by step. So we kill ourselves slowly. And finally, we'll get to where we can do just mission outreach as opposed to all these little games, you know. See, we used to have a game. You had to join the church. So we had yes sir members for 10 years. And then I got that out, and then we couldn't. And then it was, you know, such a good member. Now we got this last little, oh, this will save us, you know. Well, it won't. It'll be pain.
Okay, now, do you think that the school is successful because it's an alternative to the Detroit school system, or is the school successful because parents see in it a way, let's say, for their children to get Christian teaching?
We're having more and more people who are voicing the second now, that they appreciate that their kids are receiving some Christian teaching. Not that they're becoming Lutheran Christians, Lutheran, but that they're receiving Christian teaching. There are people who, you know, we ought not to speak about the city churches that have schools any different than we speak about any of our Lutheran schools now, because a great majority of schools in the Michigan district have a lot of non-church, non-Lutheran students in their schools. And we need to offer people in the city who are of different ethnic backgrounds, majority black in Detroit, at least in our community, people need to have the same options anybody else does. To suddenly be critical of that, I think, is to also be somewhat untrue to ourselves, and it's tossing a dart at the wrong thing. You know, we ought to make hay while we have opportunity for 5, 10, 20 years. I don't mean make hay, I mean by that, I mean, you know, to really use this as the opportunity to get into people's lives, to offer them the best way to speak the gospel that people understand. And the other thing that I think is in that, you know, is we ought to learn how to listen to folks. We've got folks wanting to tell us who they are. You know, they want to tell us their life, their being, what are their needs. We have an opportunity to hear of that through a school. We want the folks to meet our needs. You know, that's how many Lutheran churches with schools look at. They're not going to church enough like we want them to. Well, so what? I mean, you know, just because we want them to doesn't make it right. You know, let's find ways to listen why people are not worshiping, or why they are, and why we're helping, and how can we help? You know, we don't see it that way enough, in my opinion, as a synodical mindset.
Okay, I want to go back to this question of identity. In certain communities, there are certain ways of worship and certain ways of belief which seem to be more prominent than others. Working with deaf people, I'm often invited to be an interpreter. Okay, so I'll go to an AME church to do a funeral or something. Mm-hmm. And you get the impression that there is a link between a certain denomination and a certain group of people. And that has been the history of the Lutheran Church. So, you know, Saxon German Lutherans were the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. How my Hungarian mother and my Czechoslovakian father got into this is, you know, subject for another interview. But in New York, no less. At this point, you know, what's happening at Greenfield Peace, which lets people who everyone tells us should be more comfortable at the AME church begin to feel comfortable at your church? Are you changing your church to look like the AME? Are you changing them so that they like Lutherans better than AMEs? Or, you know, what's going on here?
Well, I think when you started the question, you started with somewhat the wrong premise, you know, that just because folks are black, everybody's going to want to do things a certain way. That already denies the very fact that, you know, the church that's across the street from, who was it was telling me you got a new church? You know, Eggold. Where are you at, Tom? You know, in Anderson, Indiana, you were telling me, you know, that Lutheran Church across the street is the Church of God with 3,600 members in it. Those 3,600 folk over there have nothing to do with his Lutheran Church either, and they're only, you know, 100 feet away from each other or whatever it is. And so the same dynamic applies, you know. We don't talk of all white folks that way, right? You know, but, you know, all at once we start with this presupposition, we have to treat folks differently because they're a different color. In a different race, you know, that's a presupposition. I think right away we don't come up with the right answers when we start that way.
Okay, but suppose then we presuppose that American Christianity is such that the Lutheran way of worship is unpalatable to American Christianity. Therefore, we have got to make Lutherans look like they're American Puritan Christians or something like this. Isn't that the same reasoning?
I understand what you're saying. I was just wanting to make sure that.
So give me an answer.
Well, I think, you know, an identity, you know, we ought not to be afraid of word and sacrament ministry in its best sense of what its meaning is. This afternoon, and Elmer was talking, you know, I wrote a note to myself that said, you know, the whole business of change we haven't talked about as Lutherans. We haven't talked about baptism and daily drowning and all that stuff as a dynamic of change, you know. We don't take what we have and make it really come to life. We have the best of what there is among Christianity and Christian denominations, in my opinion, as to why we ought to be in a place that is not going to be the same cultural tradition. We have the resource to change, as contrasted to we have the traditions we have to hang on to. We have the resource to change. Word and sacrament is not tradition. Word and sacrament is an empowering force for change, as contrasted to equating, you know, liturgical form is not the same as word and sacrament, although it does get expressed culturally, and we express it well within our dynamics. You know, I mean, there's some Sundays I use the TLH page 15 and chant the service. Some people just love that. You know, some people don't. Some people can't stand some of the hymns we sing in other times, you know. But I work always to make sure there's a diversity of best I know how, and the best that people have expressed that helps them get in touch with the Lord and the Lord to speak to them, you know, to try to keep in touch with that. And it's been a very conservative process, by the way, you know, in relation to where we don't have jazz masses and such stuff yet, although I got a fellow that could do it. He's just working always on Sundays, so he can't ever get practiced enough to get things going.
You may not have to. Word out there that they're passé, but
I know.
You know, if you wait long enough, this too shall pass.
Yes, and that's another point. Anytime you think that what I'm saying can be replicated somewhere else and will work, you know, is part of our insanity. I think that we're programmed is what we buy into. It's not program. It's if you really think about word and sacrament in its fullest sense, you know, that's where the power of our Lutheran identity gives us something to really offer. There's a sense of understanding. What is the sacrament of baptism? It is that which calls us into being and gives us identity as servants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and empowers us, as opposed to that which we got to fight about, whether it's Duncan, immersion, or whatever. So I say, fine, I wished I had a Lutheran church that had a pool in it, you know, and get rid of all this argument, you know.
Have you ever done that? Immersed anybody?
No, I had two people that asked, and that I was agreeable, and then they said, nah, it's not important. Once they found out, I thought it was okay. You know, then it was not. But, you know, I think it'd be appropriate. We should, you know, the digs that are going on up at Sea of Galilee and a lot of those Byzantine churches had walked in and a pool was right there in the front. You know, there's a lot more to be said for this than what I think. It would be a lot easier to teach Romans 6, wouldn't it? You know, get
well, now that's what the Baptists say, because they
they don't teach Romans 6, though. You see, I got people by the hundreds that have come and they got dunked and they don't know why. You know, I mean, they know why, because they said they got to do it, you know, but I mean, the why is what I mean, you know.
Now, is that easier because of the school? Would that be more difficult with adults? Obviously, what I think you're trying to convey to us, at least what you're conveying to me,
Okay,
is that there's an education process which says behind the facade of whether or not you make the sign of the cross, whether or not you have a guitar up front, whether or not you do this or that other thing, is the real word and sacrament, the heart of the gospel, that by the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, our sins are forgiven, yours, mine, and whatever. Now, is the education to that, and then the verbalization of that through Lutheran adiaphora means, easier because the school's there?
Oh, yes. Because you have people of various backgrounds, and people of no backgrounds, and a Mormon family, and you know, in the school, you know, I mean, you just have to figure out why you're saying what you're saying. And you have to be ready to explain that to a kindergartner who asks you the question, well, you know, my daddy says that you don't get baptized till you're 12. And why do you baptize babies? Well, you know, you just can't say, well, because we believe in it, you know. Mm-hmm. You say, well, what is baptism? You know, and you talk about the Lord. You don't say the kid's wrong or his dad's wrong. You talk about what is the power of God. What is going on here? You know, and that, to me, that cuts through all this other stuff, and it gets you so you get the Lord's Supper, you go to communion, you know, who dare commune? That's another whole question that we fight about, you know. We don't fight about it, you know, but the Missouri Synod, we fight about it, you know. Is it close, open, closed? Oh, my goodness, you know. And so we put in the bulletin, I have every week in the bulletin, a little thing about four questions to ask, you know, what it says in the catechism, every week. I highlight that, I print it out, I talk about it. I said, you know, so we teach the truth as opposed to an identity of just rules.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To me, that's what the school has offered that, yeah.
Okay, so basically there's an education component, mm-hmm. which is what feeds upon mm-hmm. Your ability to mm-hmm. communicate this gospel. And without that education component, mm-hmm. there's going to be nothing but confusion.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, what has been the history?
By the way, that's also true for bona fide inline Lutheran LCMS churches too. There, without education, there's confusion. People say, "I go to communion because you're supposed to go four times a year." You know, remember we can't. Mm-hmm. I still got two old folks that only go four times a year because Martin Luther said so. You know, no matter what I say, they still only come four times a year.
Now, given the 100-year history, do you think that Greenfield Peace is a growing church?
Yes, it can quit next year and not feel guilty. If it doesn't make it, if we don't get the bills paid, if we don't get enough money, people are not going to think like, we have lost our life. I think that's a growth. Because we're no longer worshiping the institution. We had a 100th anniversary last year. What a pain. Oh. You know, I had a few people that said, we got to celebrate this anniversary. And a few of them were newer to the church. They were some, you know, black Lutherans have been Lutherans for many years, but when a church has a 100th anniversary, you got to celebrate it. Oh, Donald, wasn't that something? You know, trying to celebrate 100th anniversary. It was just insane. You know, finally sold enough tickets to make the banquet look like it was a slight success. You know, but the whole thing was an exercise in futility because it looked at what we were, and none of us were they. You know, and so I would think a growth factor would be that if we don't make it, we haven't lost our faith. I think that's a growth thing. Now, have we grown in numbers? That's what your other question is, I'm sure. Yeah, you know, I just baptized 7 people the last month. I got 3 more in the works. You know, and people are saying, why can't I get baptized after last Sunday's lesson, you know? Why, there's no reason at all. Let's talk about this, you know. Isn't that wonderful, you know? And so out of, we lost 1,400 members, and we're on the books at 550 baptized members. And 400 of them are new in the last 12 years. That's not bad. I mean, it's not good because we haven't even come to life yet.
What would make the church come to life? Does it have, in other words, is its ministry living now? And is that its quote, lot in life?
No, it's sowing a lot of seeds now. That's all we're doing. I'm doing a lot and a few folks are doing a lot of sowing. No reaping time right now. I mean, in terms of institutional stuff. Just plain hard work, slugging it out right now. It's not survival only anymore, but it isn't beyond it by far.
Now, when you get in a situation where things are, you know, rough, or someone wants to have a 100th anniversary and things are not going well, what's the greatest temptation you have to resist? Is there a temptation to try some new gimmick to make it work?
Yes, new program.
And what are the most tempting new programs?
Well, I don't get tempted by too many programs, but I don't. I'm a circuit counselor, and I said to the district president, I said, I'll accept this appointment 3 years ago only if I don't have to sell all this stuff you send. Because the district is not out there, the district is us. And for most of our city churches, that is not a sense of identity. And I keep saying this every time you have a meeting, you know, they say, well, what does the district want? The pastor's conference meeting. I said, why do you guys keep talking about what does the district want? We are the district. When are we going to take hold of doing the district's work here and think of it that way? We're starting to. Oh, it's not just because of me, but I mean, I've been a part of that in Detroit. You know, we are the district. We are the synod. We are the church. You know, we don't have to do something to satisfy some program that makes the institution of the district look all right, you know, until we get ourselves being the wholesome people of God in Christ, you know, become that, you know, we are going to be of no good to the district, and the district will be of no good to us. We cannot receive handouts in the sense of institutional mission and ministry goals and think that we're in mission and ministry. We are patronized and we're caretakers at best. And most of our urban churches have been perceived as caretaking ministries. And it's a hard thing to not be that when you have to caretake this place to survive.
What turns that perception around? Is it the very fact that the dynamic is once you leave this place, there ain't nobody going to take care of it, and if there's nobody here, it's going to die?
Yeah, that's survival.
You know, in other words, is it that you transfer them out? Was that policy a great boon to your being able to be a growing church?
Yes and no. The yes was there wouldn't have been nearly as many people come in as quickly as they did when they did come. You know, we have some traditions established now. We have Pentecost Sunday, which is big. We have kids in the school making flames and their greeters, and another grade they sell geraniums, and we pack the church with geraniums on Pentecost Sunday. It's a new tradition. We have a new tradition of I don't know what the, you know, but it's what I'm working toward is that everything that happens out of the worship experience. The boards of the church are starting to disintegrate a bit, well, quite a bit. You know, we have to put boards to death too.
We got a lot of folks, well, not too many now, but I know a lot more. I know a lot of folks. But, you know, we got some people that really go outreach. Now, that's supposed to be the elders' responsibility, but see, they haven't got a hold of that.
So somebody else is going to.
Listen, they're a board.
See,
and we haven't. That's what I mean. We got to empty the boards. You know, that connection to tradition in the past. Because they haven't been able to do that.
Okay, I think we'll throw it open for questions now. I want to thank you for your candidness.
Yeah, there's one more thing I'd like to share, if I could. Sure. You know, one of the things that has struck me over this time is I've been trying to find ways. All my ministry, by the way, has been in the black community. And my relatives, you know, always wonder why I don't want to go to a successful church yet. They still say that at times.
Work with those heathen.
Well, no longer is that kind of, that's not the spot that's made. It's just that, you know, you ought to be able to get in a place you don't have to work so hard. In my opinion, I think it'd be hell to work in a place where you don't have to work. By that I mean where you don't have to live by faith. You know, if everything operates, that must be terrible, to be on a treadmill of nothing to challenge your faith. You know, we always are living not by sight, you know. And one more thing. How to model. The biggest struggle I have going in my mind is how to model that some of the leaders of the parish who are black, who have a lot of experience as churchmen, why they and I yet cannot be perceived as truly being equals. That just tears apart at me, even though I know it, I understand the history, I understand racism, and I mean, I understand what that does to people. But somehow, to model that we are on the same, as opposed to we are still perceived as a church as accepting folks. Until we get past that, there will be no growth. That's the whole same struggle with any ethnic ministry. You know, when we are accepting others, then we ain't going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
How to do that? That's a struggle. Donald and I last year tried to model some of that a little bit, and it would have been fun to be together about 3-4 years, you know, to get that sort of thing really going. But president of my congregation, he and I are at it right now. We're trying to dare to have our disputes public. By dispute, I mean an issue that dares we talk about publicly, and he's trying to model that folks can disagree with the pastoral office. You know, there's this perception you can go to your pastor over here and disagree, but you can't come to the Lutheran Church and disagree. There's some, I mean, it's not only true. I have folks who disagree with me, but I mean in terms of the vision, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, any questions from the floor?
Anything's okay to ask.
Rick?
Belonging is too much of it yet.
Mm-hmm. The question was, is their identity to the church or their identity to the denomination? Is that the question?
Yeah, in terms of how they look at themselves, their faith, what they
believe. Now, if you ask me what they believe, you know, I think folks come and once we get through what are understanding a concept of sin or sins, to me that's the handle. People grasp that, then we've moved past some of this stuff in terms of I got to save myself, I got to get better, I'll make it someday. And that's usually the fun 3-4 weeks of teaching I do, you know, because when people grasp that, then they understand what grace is, you know. So they're Lutherans, but their identity is not as Lutherans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more Lutherans running around, by the way, than there are Lutherans. Yeah.
Yep, Schneider.
Well, they're not yet. That's just an idea. That's. I would prefer that we would see it as a need to be met, and that certain people would be willing to be identified as those who are willing to meet that need. See, the nursing thing ties in with some of the, at least in Detroit anyway, I guess it's more nationwide, but you know, many of the black churches have a nursing corps, and that nursing corps coordinates the care ministries, both of the sick, the shut-in, the needy, you know, as well as having a nurse available during times of getting the spirit and falling out, etc., you know, as well as at funerals to be at the home with a family hour and such. So that in Detroit, that concept, few people picked up on that. So it takes 3 years for an idea to come out of people, you know. I I don't know how it's going to get coordinated. Am I afraid of their doing it, or am I afraid of losing my... I would certainly hope that these would be people who would care for one another, and that's what I perceive it as the caring network, but in a word that is more easily grasped than the setting up. We have a shepherding program, too, that hasn't caught on at all. I mean, it's caught on, but so slightly, because it's a foreign concept. The word is not used. And I remember having a discussion with him at the beginning. I said I thought it sounded too formal, you know, the wrong word, and I think it was. And I think if we'd have called it the nursing corps, even right off the bat, I think it would have caught on, you know, it would have communicated better. I'm not sure that's the right answer. But.
The question was about, you know, the pastoral office and how the pastoral office plays its role in the activities of the members of the congregation. Now, you mentioned that some other churches had similar things. I'm reminded of a story I heard down in Florida by a fellow who was pastor of a church and wanted to have a meeting on Tuesday night or something. And all the people said, well, we couldn't possibly have a meeting on Tuesday night. And he said, why not? And they said, well, because on Tuesday night we go to the Episcopal Church and pray for the sick. And he said, well, why do you go to the Episcopal Church to pray for the sick? He said, because we don't pray for the sick here. He said, well, next week we're praying for the sick here. And the whole new program started that way, the same kind of thing. So you look around, and there are good things to emulate as well as others that you may not want to. Alma had a question.
There are needs to be met.
Yeah.
Five families total, 27 member families, 24 now non-church families, and the rest are some identification with some other church. However, we only have 30% of the available member families, kids in the school, because it was the member families that got the most mad a few years ago and we had to raise this tuition. Because their commitment level was yesterday membership to get their kids in. So, you know, we bastardized the whole process, you know, by having all these silly rules. And they're really misguided rules, in my opinion. Policies that destroy what you're about. If you're going to go to tuition, skip all the other stuff. Say it costs so much to run this place. If you can't find enough people to pay for it, get out of it, you know. I mean, if you don't have any other resources of income, why? And people aren't willing or unable to pay, then get out of that program for a while. But we didn't do it that way. I would just advise people that way, no.
Somebody else had their hand in the back. Yeah, Chuck?
Right when you first started off, I didn't quite understand when you said that you were forced to transfer everybody because they moved across Canada.
We weren't forced to. It was a congregational decision of the leadership at that time that if you don't live in this community, we are not going to try to hold on to folks who move 20 miles out. There are churches in those communities. We will send your transfer.
But that's not your position now.
Oh, yeah. I still, if people move out 15 miles, I tell them, you know, I understand you've been having a hard time with identifying with what's going on in this community, and are you willing to keep working at it? And if not, it's all right for you to transfer.
That's because they want to.
Well, they want to move. And when they move, I ask them, you know. Yeah, because once you decided, you know, it's not starting to change around at that point. At this point in the game, it's an experiment. It was an experiment when we started. The terrible part of it was we lost all our leadership base and financial base.
Right, that's right.
But which is worse, to lose that and then lose the outreach to new folks to get them involved, you know, because none of them would have been involved if we'd have kept the same 30 leaders, you know, because they'd all kept things like they were, you know. And it had me gone a long time ago, I think, but anyway.
John?
Do you feel that you wind up compromising?
Well, I don't think the parish I'm at would have any danger of getting too many people doing that, you know, so we would lose that. Are you saying being fed, you mean in terms of spiritually fed, you know, is that what you're talking about? Yeah, I agree, you can't do the other unless it's a response to your having been fed. Yeah, and that's what I meant, that I think would come from the worship, sharing, receiving from the Lord, worshiping the Lord, taking care of the household of faith, which would then grow out of that. And it's going to have to be perceived as a response to the presence of the Lord, not something I do to take care of everything, because we can't do that. We cannot be all things to all people in that sense to meet all needs. There's no way that any parish can do that, let alone the one I'm at. I'm not sure I follow if you're... I wasn't pushing that we're going to suddenly organize the whole place to meet all bunch of needs. I was just meaning even the whole parish life right now, you know, is moving toward a crisis point of identity, and it's one common factor that will be taking place that people are focusing around is around the worship experience. And so from that, you know, will be the common outgrowth again to redefine what is the wholeness of being the body of Christ. Now that's kind of a vision that's coming into place for me where I'm at right now at this place. I'm working with Victor's the last 6 years. I've been struggling with, you know, trying to say to these young fellows, you know, what is this ministry? you know, and of course we always come with, let's have all this structured, organized, and what are we doing? Well, some days I don't know. I know a lot of things I know what's doing, but you know, where is this place going? I don't know. 5 years from now, I have no idea that it's going to be here. Because we are operating everything by the will of the people around us. You know, tuition-based, you put yourself on a faith level, folks. You know, it has nothing to do with running a school. You have no power over people. It's just like church. You don't like it, you stay away. You know, the whole existence of the...
Or you get a real quality education.
Say what?
Or you get a real quality education. And it's not living by faith, it's living because we got great schools.
Yeah. Well, but... Is there anything unchristian about offering quality education? No. I mean, that's something else I think we got to be a little more upfront about the state. To run a good school as good as you can, which may be better than the other option at that point in time, but you can't deny getting involved in the public sector either, I don't think. And that's where I think Lutherans have to learn we can't be avoiding, we have to be both and.
I'd like to move over to Howard and then next call.
The school is 98% black and the congregation is, on the books, 85%. And the worshiping congregation is 90 to 95% black every Sunday.
Okay, May?
One thing to add to one of those, I think the insight on baptism is what's helped me a lot.
you know, that baptism itself is that dynamic that we have that helps us to repent and change daily. And of all the institutions that ought to know how to deal with change, it ought to be the church. And of all Christian denominations that ought to know how to do that well, it ought to be the Lutherans. You know, well, we have the freedom to change as contrasted to the policies that we've got to worship. You know, I mean, our theology, at least our confessional base anyway, ought to permit that. We are the most free to change because every day we admit that we daily sin much and indeed deserve nothing but, you know, but the Lord is gracious. Start again. Now, I'm down some days sabbatic and hard to function, by the way, you know. It was 82, I don't remember 3 months of 1982, 2.5 months. It was so bad that I don't remember it. I look at the calendar. I know I met with a lot of people, government. I don't remember any of it. I was close to burnout plus.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe we'll take two more. I'll take Howard and then Harley. Oh, three more. Okay.
Don had his hand up back there.
Did he? No?
Oh.
Okay.
Simultaneous. Well, because they had this policy that said you had to join the church to get your kids in. That's how it changed originally. But there was a decision that anybody who wanted to join that church could before it was the required thing to do in Detroit.
Okay, Harley?
You talked about we accepting them and going nowhere as long as that sort of attitude persists, and I don't see that as being a thing that was kept persistent, of course, in an established, old, historical downtown church. Can it also happen in church planting? Are there some ways that we do things, and our district do things, or whatever, in the urban setting, which is just a rehash, even with the new trappings of church planting that comes across as we accept it as true, so that even new congregations struggle with that very same thing?
Well, I guess we're trying some experiments in Detroit. We have an old Mount Olive Lutheran Church that is now a new Mount Olive Lutheran Church. It started with a daycare center and total new group of folks. You know, it hasn't made it to become living on its own yet, but that's an experiment. There's also an experiment right now with a lay minister who's establishing home Bible study cell groups around the city and trying to develop that sort of a concept to see if enough of those could be developed and then be pulled together as a group of folks that have no background identity with a Lutheran church of what any kind. So that's going on in Detroit right now. And we have a grant from the LCEF right now through the district to have a congregational, well, a visit, the old concept of visitator, you know, the old circuit counselor, circuit visitor thing, but somebody who comes in and helps us for 2 months at a time to go through not just self-studies, but the whole thing. And the fellow that we have kind of on board is non-Missouri Synod background, but he's a pastor, and so we're going to try that out to see if that kind of works. It isn't just to gain new members, but, you know, for heaven's sake, we ought not to think that we have to just take care of old institutions in the city either. You know, we got to risk trying like we risk trying in other places in the church. But I understand what you're saying. We might just set up the new to be exactly like the old. Yeah. I don't know how to get out of that view.
Well, you have to be creative, I think, like you said, over here, and then Elmer will close.
But you can be creative. Just like I said, you get creative, but I'm in a rut already, in a sense. You know, I create some of the same new stuff over and again, you know, different words, but I do it that same way, you know.
Okay.
Like we were alluding to this a little bit earlier this afternoon, we were talking about the writings of Roland Allen, particularly one of his writings, where he talks about missionary methods, St. Paul and ours. Think of how much freedom the apostle had to go in and proclaim the gospel and make it clear and so forth. And boy, then they had the full-blown ministry right there. The Holy Spirit was at work in their hearts and lives, and the gospel, word, and sacrament were right there, and he moved on. The work in the tradition of keeping the man from Jerusalem there, the profession almost, so that people don't quite feel, I guess, that they can handle it themselves, that sort of thing. And maybe we need to examine our whole approach.
Yesterday morning, Monday morning, the Detroit Pastors Conference, about 15, 16 of us were there, debated and fought over, I mean, we weren't fighting, but debated as to some were evangelists, some prophets, some pastors and teachers, and we have somehow equated the apostleship with pastorate, you know, in our practice in the Christian church, not just the Missouri Synod, and somehow maybe that's one of our issues. We have hooked up, we didn't do a lot of serious historical study, but the conversation had to do with this. Why have we elevated the office of pastor out of that list that Paul gives in Ephesians? You know, it's not the answer, it was just a question that kind of ties in with what you're saying. How do we see the gifts and the needs, and how do we mesh that as the body of Christ? Paul would walk away and say, some folks are going to be able to take care of this. There are folks who will meet these needs. The Lord will provide, you know. How do we believe that? You know, even in the setting where I'm at, you know, do we believe? You know, we talked about this afternoon, a middle-class church mentality, you know. We don't believe as a denomination that churches sired by, owned by, developed in and with anybody other than us are going to be successful in the Lutheran Church. You know, we don't think that people who would have lower middle class incomes would sacrifice to develop a Lutheran Church. You know, we don't believe that. We have to learn from folks. We've got to find out ways to listen to how is it that are right across the street from me, you know, they can build a new church down the street in a matter of, and pay for it within a matter of, you know, 2 years. You know, and we're struggling to get the first penny out. Something about we haven't yet heard each other.
And for the last word, we'll get to Ellen Mathias.
Oh, no.
Well, I just want to express my appreciation for this presentation. Is very exciting. And I find it exciting because here's a practitioner. A seminary instructor can become a theoretician and have a lot of ideas. And I'll become in 9 years a better theoretician. But I can't do it. And here we have a practitioner that comes in and shares actually how theology is done and how you do it. I think that's an important part of a program for this kind of thing.
You know, I would, what is it, your name, John Johnson?
Yes.
Yeah. What he said before is right. You know, we get it hooked up into mimicking somebody else or some other place and all that. And that's right, you know, and I'm trying not to do that, you know, just like I don't try to take what Synod said. I am the Synod, for heaven's sake. I am the Synod, you know, and this business about what does the district want, what does the district say, I become what I treat people of other culture, races, etc., at least when I am mistreating, I become the same, I put myself in that, this is a subservient role, I become less than what I am, you know. I am the Synod, and I will work hard to be the best at that. I will work hard also at being, living by faith, and it gets you pain. There's no joy in it. I mean, no joy there is, but no success in it always. That's what I meant to get at. The joy sometimes is hard-pressed because we look for joy by, you know, success in some ways. See, success has to be measured not by what you get, by what you give. And we got to really get more people thinking that, you know, it's by what you give.